nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So, since we are starting a bit late, I'll try to go through this more quickly so you can end on time. Effectively, what we'll talk about is camphor in more detail, because like last time I said, camphor can give you all these really cool results for photonic crystals, right? And I kind of explained like the mathematics behind this, but I didn't explain either the programming structure or how to actually like write code in it. Okay, so that's what I'll do today. So just to kind of recap what we said last time, we basically had a proposition, which was that for every like layer in a multi-layer structure, that we should be able to represent eigenmodes of the system as like a more natural basis than just a basically a sum of plane waves. So instead of like trying to fit every system, regardless of its specific layer geometry, into like a Fourier series basis, then we say that we'll let the shape of the basis and the geometry of the problem dictate the basis that we're using instead, right? So the potential advantage is that it's much more computationally efficient because we only need a few modes. And then we said, you know, once we have those modes, then we need to use Lorentz reciprocity to match the modes when you have like layers that are not the same as one another, but adjoining one another. And then once we have those two things out of the way, which are different from what we did in the other S matrix methods, like the RCWA, then we can propagate within or between the layers and calculate physical outputs. Okay, so that's like the math or the physics behind this approach. Now, in terms of the programming aspects, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on that, but I wanted to kind of point out how this is a little different from some other numerical codes that are out there. So one key concept for camphor was that there should be three types of architectural elements: user interface, core logic, and low-level numerical routines that are as much as possible independent and orthogonal to one another. So basically all of the user interface code should be encapsulated at that level of user interface. But then it should be able to reach down and then link into the core logic when needed, but only through very specific, well-defined interfaces and to the kind of minimal extent possible that still enables all the functionality that's necessary. Right. And so this is like an important concept for some of the more advanced like numerical software that's out there, because it's very easy if you just kind of naively start on a project of this type that you're going to have a little bit of user interface, and then you're going to like perform some like numerical stuff, and then you'll call like the low level numerical routines. Maybe you'll even cut and paste them into your code. Right. And so everything will get mixed together. The reason why it's so important to separate these is that allows like a modularity of reuse. So if there are certain things that you develop that are very nice, then you can like bring that into other projects. But then additionally, it gives you a much greater level of transparency and maintainability compared to just kind of mixing everything together. So that approach of just like kind of throwing everything together into like one big ball of code is usually called spaghetti coding. And so the point is, for a project of this type that's very ambitious, you should really try to avoid that, even though it creates a lot more work on the front end than like further down the line in the subsequent years of use, then it becomes much more solid and lasting. Because I think camphor was developed like kind of initially almost 10 years ago, and people are still using it, and there is a new version released this year, actually. So how do we do that? So I think if you guys have not taken object-oriented programming classes like in C++ or Java, I just wanted to give you the basic premise. And if you've seen this all before, please forgive me. But the real key here is to create abstract data types and data structures, which are our objects, right? So you probably know, like in C, there are things like structs that can accommodate like more than one like real or floating point numbers, right? But then here, you're not just creating like a set of variables, but you're also creating methods which interact with those variables and with the other objects. And then there's also an idea of inheritance. So basically, if you create one object, then the subsequent objects can inherit some of those properties, but also add new properties. And so you can have like a whole bunch of like related codes, but you don't have to rewrite from scratch, right? And you don't have to like cut and paste everything, which is really nice. And it becomes reusable for other software projects. And then there's also kind of a related concept of polymorphism. And so in polymorphism, the idea is that you can have like certain operators or procedures that will be sensitive to the data types that they receive when you call them, and then will act in appropriate fashion based on what you're passing them. So in practice, what this amounts to is there are multiple templates for like a certain procedure, and then each template can be called depending on the circumstances. And so it allows you to kind of write the code in a very intuitive way. And so like the most classic example of this is like a polymorphism for the plus operator. So instead of just like kind of the direct like integer addition, like a plus b, then you can also start adding very abstract concepts like layers, like layer structures in together with one another. And so this is like an example of kind of the inheritance concept, where you start off with like a waveguide type, and then you have like two specific types of waveguides, both a slab waveguide, which is in Cartesian coordinates, and then a circular waveguide in cylindrical coordinates. Okay, just to give you some sense of, you know, what are we aiming at. And this happens to be done in Python, but Python, of course, is not the only way to do object-oriented. It's just the most convenient way for this project. And another solid choice is C++, of course, or Java. And there are probably more languages than I can think of that would do something similar. But I think the concept is the most fundamental thing rather than the language, because you're not guaranteed to get object-oriented programming just because you use those languages. Okay. And then this is like kind of a more elaborate diagram showing not only like this, you know, waveguide and then the slab and circular waveguide structure, but also shows how it interconnects with like the more abstract concepts in this code. So like basically the interface layer, the scattering mechanism, the idea of having a stack of like multiple layers interacting with one another, which is like kind of the composition of individual layer pairs, I guess. And then on this upper end, kind of like the specific types of calculations that you might need for like either understanding the physics, like a band structure, or like for applications, like finding lazing modes of a system. And I'll show you some examples of some of these outputs later. I kind of showed you already a little bit of the band structure you can get from 2D photonic crystals, right? And you can kind of see that a general scattering problem can have all of these like things kind of branching out from it. And so all these like objects are encapsulated and interacting with each other in specified ways that are thought out like in the beginning of the project rather than at the end. So hopefully that makes sense. Any questions of this stage? Okay. So now I'm going to actually go through some of the code and kind of show you how you can use this. So now, unfortunately, this is not, as far as I understand, implemented on NanoHub, although I would like to do that, actually. For now, if you wanted to use this, like, for example, in your final project or for your research, then what you would need to do is basically download the source code from the SourceForge website, and then you would need to load all the support packages. So I think the key packages here are Python 2.7, and then there's NumPy, I think 1.6, and then SciPy, I'm trying to remember, 0.8, I think. And then matplotlib. And then, of course, Camper itself. Okay, so you need to install all these. So this is part of why I would like to have it on NanoHub, because while this is okay for me to do this, like, I don't think that, you know, the more casual users or people who are unfamiliar with Camper will want to do this. Okay.
But free?
Yeah, it's all free. Yeah. And there are versions both for Windows and Linux and Mac OS. So most major operating systems. I'm not sure if it works in Android. If you wanted to do it on your phone, but, so anyway. If you start off with just a very simple structure like this, okay? Like, this is basically a 1D waveguide problem, okay? So what we really want to see is, like, what kind of mode is going to exist in this high index region and travel in this Z direction, so Z is direction of propagation, and then what, like, 1D profile would it have in both the gallium arsenide and the air, okay? That's basically the goal. And this is just like the geometric parameters that we're using, like 0.6 microns, 2 and 2. Okay. So, what is everything doing? So first of all, this from Camper import star, this is, when you're installing it, where all the headaches will occur, because you're basically trying to get it to load the Camper library correctly. So unless you have everything here installed, then this will fail. Okay, so this is very important. And then, assuming you get that to work, then the next step is to basically set the wavelength or the frequency alternatively. And then set n basically is setting the number of eigenmodes that we're allowing in the system. And remember, our hypothesis was that we don't need as many eigenmodes as we needed plane waves before. So that's why we're picking what may sound like kind of a low number of 20. And we'll find that actually it looks pretty good, even with 20. Okay? Yep.
Those three lines are predefined function in Camper's library?
Yeah. So I guess just to be clear, basically, like, all the stuff that's in red is basically, like, a variable that's defined either in Python or in Camper. And then the blue stuff is like a variable defined specifically just in this code. Okay, so this is like a more specific or idiosyncratic thing. And then you'll also see other like green text, and those are all comments. So that's just to kind of explain what's going on. So I guess the point is, the next step is basically to set the polarization. It turns out that we're coming in from normal incidence, so it doesn't actually matter right now. But anyway, so we do set it to something. Then we set basically the refractive indices of these different material types, gallium arsenide and air. Of course, air has index of 1. Gallium arsenide, we assume, has index of 3.5. That's only assumed at this specific wavelength, lambda equals 1. We can change that at different wavelengths if we want, so we can include dispersion in a realistic fashion. And so this actually is very easy to do in frequency domain if we have, a dispersion data already. Then we basically set up this structure with the 2 microns of air, 0.5 micron of gallium arsenide, and then 2 microns of air. Okay, so we just like basically do this plus this plus this. And so this goes back to the polymorphism thing earlier. Now you might think, like, if you're just used to like the C paradigm, that this looks really silly to like just try to add you know, data structures together directly, when they're like, you know, different materials and different like boundary conditions and so on and so forth. But basically, like, Camphor has transparently allowed you to basically add these things together so you can write code in a way that looks very intuitive. The backend maybe is not so intuitive if you're a developer, but for users, I think it's really good. So then you basically kind of tie everything together into a single slab region. Okay, so that's the slab that's on the outside. And then you can perform the basic like mode calculation with slab.calc. So calc is called a member function of the slab, capital slab class. The lowercase slab is an instance of that class, in case you're not familiar with object-oriented programming. Is anybody new to object-oriented programming? Okay. Oh, okay. That's okay. That's okay. Initially, I was planning to assume everybody knew object-oriented programming, and I decided not to assume that, to like try to broaden the scope of the class. But the point is that there are a number of member functions that are listed in the user guide and the tutorial that you can look up on SourceForge if you want to use it. And then once you have that set up, you can calculate all kinds of stuff, but I'm just going to focus on what comes out of plot. Okay, because plot is like an interactive way to look at this data that was generated here. And so if you run plot, you'll see the E field has the spatial distribution that looks something like this. And so this region from 2 to 2.5 is where the gallium arsenide is. And so you see that like kind of like the vast majority of the field is localized to this region from 2 to 2.5. And then there's like this little kind of like a tail, evanescent tail, that goes from about 2 to maybe like 1.8, 1.9, and then from about 2.5 to 2.7, say. And so roughly speaking, it kind of corresponds to this error region just outside. And you see that, like, because, like, we used eigenmode decomposition, we got, like, a very, like, good resolution of the spatial profile, even though we only use 20 modes, right? So like in order to get equal spatial resolution with plane waves, then we probably need like at least 100 modes, I would think. And then another thing that we can get that's really cool from this interactive plotting program is kind of a set of all the effective indices, like basically like all the eigenmodes that are present in the system. And so this kind of shows like where they live. Okay. And because there are no losses, that's why everything is like on the pure real or pure imaginary axis. Okay. So that's what's happening. And basically the ones that are, on the pure real axis are kind of behaving like, signs, and the ones on pure imaginary are just decaying. Okay. So does that make sense? Hopefully. So, yeah. So basically, light is coming up from here and just propagating forever in this z direction. So basically what I've shown you here, it's like a slice along the z, but it keeps going past here. So this is like kind of the steady state mode profile when it's traveling for a long period of time. So what's cool about this is you can get this like really fast, and you're not just limited to 1D, of course. Like this is just kind of the beginning. But it's hopefully like easy enough to understand like almost analytically. So you can kind of see, you know, how your analytical understanding carries over into this numerical method very nicely.
What if you lower the number of sample? How will it affect?
Yeah. So I think if you lower the number of modes a little bit, it'd probably be okay. But then if you start like lowering it too much, like, you know, you only included like 2 or 3 modes, then I'm not sure if it would be very accurate. So you could actually play around with it to see how low can you go before it starts having problems. That'd be a good exercise if you can get it up and running. Like I said, I would like to get it like running on NanoHub, but I can't like guarantee I'll do that immediately. So I would recommend like basically do this procedure on whatever OS you use if you want to use it like for your project. And if you have problems installing it, I'll be happy to help you. Okay, so let's look at a 2D example, all right? So in this example, we're going to say we have something similar to what I showed you before, but now this only has a finite length. It's not infinite in the Z direction, okay? And the length is capital L, all right? And we want to look at, like, if we have some kind of source coming in from here, you know, how much of that will be reflected from this structure, right, which includes air region before and after? How much is going to be transmitted, like T12 effectively? And then I guess we can even look at, like, what happens if we input from the other side. This case is symmetric, of course, so it doesn't matter. But so what's the difference from before? So I'm skipping over the stuff we already saw, and now I'm constructing two different... Oh, wait, I think this is probably a typo, because this should all be error, I think. Sorry. This should be error 4.5, the space. So the point is that we'll have this slab, which is the same as before, and then we'll have this slab, which is just completely air. And then we have to, like, calculate the eigenmodes for each of these layers, this and this, and then, of course, this is the same as this, right? And then we need to match them at all these boundaries using, like, that Lorentz reciprocity theorem boundary condition. And then the way that we tell Camphor to do that for us is we create what's called a stack. And then the stack consists of this space, which we can give, we can assign a length 0 because the initial and final slabs are considered to be semi-infinite. Okay, so that's why we can give it 0. And then this one in the middle has a length L. And then this one also semi-infinite. Then we perform the calculation. So that's, again, member function for both stack and for the slab, right? And so this kind of goes back to the idea of inheritance that we talked about earlier. Like, so this calc member function reoccurs in, like, a lot of the different objects. And then the original code called for printing this out to, like, some array of data, but instead I'm going to show you a plot. So before I show you the data, let me just ask you, like, so if this was length 0, what should happen? Yeah. So what's the reflection in free space? 0, right. Yeah. So the reflection will start at 0. And then what happens if this becomes, like, relatively long? Yeah. So presumably it won't couple very well to this mode. Like, if we have a plane wave starting here, and then we have a mode that's kind of, like, localized to this high index region, and then the width is relatively narrow compared to this plane wave, then the amount of coupling from here to here will be weak, and so reflection will be large, right? But the thing is that if this is very short, then we can have a tunneling event where this input plane wave kind of jumps over to here, right? So we want to, like, kind of see, do we capture that physics? Okay. And so what I have here is effectively, like, the reflection of this multi-layer stack as a function of that length of the gallium arsenide. And so you can see that although I didn't go exactly to 0, it looks like it's converging on 0 for very small L. And then as you increase, then it kind of starts off linearly, and then it actually goes up even slightly faster than linearly, but then it flattens out again. So why is that happening? So presumably, it's not just a tunneling effect, but there's some sort of interference effect. So we can actually induce that if the reflection is being suppressed at certain wavelengths, then that means that there's, like, a destructive interference between the reflected modes at the front of that waveguide and then the back of the waveguide. And so then that's causing, like, a small decrease in this overall linear trend that we might have initially expected. And then, of course, if you go to a large enough L, then it's going to start to saturate, right? Because you can't have more than 100% reflection. Okay. So, but I guess the point is, like, you can see, like, some, like, interesting and kind of convincing physics coming out of this simulation, which is very fast. If you try to do this, like, in some other codes that we'll talk about later, it would probably take longer. So this is very fast for this problem. Okay, and then another problem that's kind of interesting to think about is, like, what if we did all of this stuff that we were just talking about, but instead of have the waveguide just be, like, kind of like this 1D cross-section, like this, then we're actually going to create, like, this circular waveguide, okay? So the cross-section will actually look like this, and then we'll have, like, some air surrounding it, and then we'll have, like, some boundary conditions that are absorbing. Okay? So basically, like, the idea is, like, that this will be radius r, and then this will be 1 minus r. Like, so the overall structure will be radius 1. Okay? And so you may think, like, this is going to be a lot more time consuming because this is actually a 3D problem now. However, in this problem, what we've done is we've actually insisted that we set the azimuthal quantum number, which is called the circular order here, to be equal to zero. And so then that sets, like, that there's no azimuthal variation in the fields, okay? And then if we wanted something that looked more like a plane wave from the last problem, we would actually pick azimuthal quantum number of 1. So set circ order 1 instead. Okay. So we can basically pick, like, different, like, input waveforms in 3D based on this circ order. If we want something that does not match, like, let me just make sure I'm clear about this. If we say that our E field goes like e to the I m phi, then m is our circular order. Okay? And so for m equals 0, then e is just the function of rho. Okay? And then m equals 1, then we get something like e is e of rho times cosine of phi. That's probably the easiest way to think about it. Right, if we just take the real part. And then for m equals 2, then maybe it's something like e equals e of rho times cosine of 2 phi. And then so on, right? And then you can also include sine by basically making this into a complex number, right? Because now I'm just saying, like, the real part of e, assuming that this is a real valued function. So you can include sines and cosines. But what if your source is not exactly like just a set of sines and cosines? Well, so based on, like, what we know about the Fourier series, then we should be able to create any arbitrary excitation, basically decompose that into a Fourier series of sine and cosines, and then create that excitation. And so what that would consist of numerically is we would run this simulation for different circular orders and then add those all together, okay? But I'm not going to do that now, okay? I'm just going to do one for the moment. But I just wanted to point out that that's possible. And so, again, we're going to basically, like, run, like, a range of times. But here, actually, we're going to assume that this length is actually fixed at 1/2. And then we're going to vary the radius of this instead. Okay. So what you may expect is that as r goes to zero, then you have air, 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 right? So that's like free space, right? But then as r increases, then there's going to be much more of an impedance mismatch between this layer and this layer. And so then the reflection is going to go up. However, it doesn't necessarily go up in a straight line because there are a lot of interference effects here as well, because, like, this length is specifically set to be, like, kind of the wavelength scale, And then this radius is also wavelength scale. So you have like multiple interference in 3D. So I don't want to make too many predictions, but I'll just say like reflection should be low when R equals zero, and then it should get higher. But we don't know exactly where these peaks will occur from interference. And so what you see here in this graph is that the reflection indeed appears to be coming from a very low value. This row is not going all the way to zero, so that's part of why it looks like it's not down at zero yet. But it'll go down smoothly to zero here. But you can see that there are a number of these different peaks, okay, for these different structures. And you might think that calculating all this stuff in 3D would take like a really long time. Like maybe it takes me like 5 hours to get this graph. But actually it only takes like 2 minutes on a regular laptop. Okay. Because this is using both the eigenmodes and then the cylindrical symmetry to effectively reduce the problem to just solving for eigenmodes of like two different types of circular slabs, and then matching those boundary conditions before and after. Okay, so like the number of modes that you're actually dealing with is probably no greater than 40, even though it looks like a really complicated problem with all these interference effects and all these like reflection peaks and so on. So that kind of makes sense, what I did there. And like I said, you can basically do this for any kind of source excitation you want. It doesn't have to be something that's like just dependent on rho. You can include sine and cosine or whatever you want. So now I'll do an even more ambitious problem, at least what I think is more ambitious. So now I want to say, as you know, like if you have like a optical network, like maybe you want to send optical data to two or more ports, right? But let's say that you're trying to do this inside of a computer, right? You don't have a lot of extra space probably. So then let's see, can we do this actually like on a very small scale? Unfortunately, like traditional fiber optics don't allow you to do that, because there's a very weak contrast between the cladding and the core. So BPM would basically tell you, don't use a wide angle, basically allow a very slow variation and splitting to occur over like a distance of maybe a millimeter. Okay. But now we're going to say, no, we want it to be much more aggressive. So instead of doing this over a millimeter, we want to do it over less than a micron at the nanoscale. So how do we do that? So effectively, we create this photonic crystal structure here. And so what this consists of is first an initial photonic crystal waveguide. That's our input. And I believe that, let's see. So this is called the central waveguide here, CEN. Okay, this part here. So these three periods. And then there's one period in which we call the vertical section where the splitting is occurring. And since like the distance from here to here is just like one period of this photonic crystal, then this is on the order of a few hundred nanometers for optical wavelengths, depending on the refractive index. Okay. And then there's this other third slab that consists of the two outer arms. So we have like a few periods with the photonic crystals above, in the middle, and below. Okay. And then we basically create a waveguide as a stack of both this and then a no rods region to kind of like have like a semi-infinite solution for our waveguide, and then find the lowest waveguide mode, and then couple that lowest waveguide mode into the system and then out here. Okay. So this is actually a very complicated problem, just to be clear, because a lot of things have to happen. Because first you have to figure out what geometry do you want in order to display that wavelength scale. And then second, you have to figure out what is the, you know, infinite waveguide solution, like the steady state mode that would be coming in. And then to track how it actually gets split in this very short distance. Now, if you tried to do this in BPM, then this would probably fail miserably because this is just two graded like a second derivative in C in terms of the math, right? And in terms of the physics of the problem, then basically the point is that we tend to ignore in BPM what happens at these like very sharp angled branches. Okay. But the hope is that in Camphor that we can actually get this right. And also to track if there's any reflection, and if so, to quantify how much reflection is occurring. So I don't actually have enough time to go through all the results, but basically this illustration of how the splitting can occur, basically plotting the field profile as a function of position in this like splitter. And then what you find is that the two branches of the output are only attenuated by 3 dB relative to the source. You can kind of see that just visually because you see these are a little more intense in color than these, right? But on the other hand, you have two arms. And so actually the overall losses of the system are very, very low. And then the reflection backwards is also very, very low. So I think the point is that this compares favorably in terms of what happens with index guided fibers over a much longer length, right? Like more like a millimeter instead of like the nanoscale. So now you've like miniaturized the whole system like more than a factor of 1,000. So one other thing I wanted to show you that I think is really cool. It's vertical cavity surface emitting lasers. And there's actually been another recent breakthrough called the photonic crystal surface emitting laser, which is actually very similar to this. And so basically what you're trying to do is create like very strong quantum confinement for light in some sort of structure that has the capability of generating photons. So this may be similar to an LED almost, okay? But the difference is that you create like such a strong feedback mechanism and you have enough gain so that you have not just spontaneous emission but also stimulated emission, and you can pass the lasing threshold with a reasonable amount of input power. Okay, so the argument is if you can miniaturize this thing enough, then you can actually emit a tremendous amount of laser light in a very small form factor, right? So it doesn't have to be as big as my laser pointer that I'm holding right here, but it can be on like a chip scale. And so here basically is showing you like the setup for how to like calculate a structure like this. So, I mean, of course, it's getting a little more complicated, so we're including more modes now. And then we're using the cylindrical symmetry and M equals one mode because we want to have input and output that's like a plane wave now. So that's why this is one. And then we have absorbing boundary conditions on the outside because we want everything to be emitted vertically, hence the name. So this is basically setting up like kind of the raw materials that go into the system. And then we kind of stack all of these different layers on top of one another. And one thing you'll notice here that may be a little surprising or confusing is that we have a 24 here, okay, times the sum, okay? So what this means basically is we're creating like a 24 period bilayer of two different materials, gallium arsenide and aluminum gallium arsenide. The reason we choose these ones specifically is that it's usually easy to have alternating stacks of those two materials with very high materials quality through MOCVD because they're lattice matched. But ignoring that detail, the main point is that we're creating both a top layer and a bottom layer, right? So the top layer is 25 periods, and so it's 24 and a half, I guess, technically. And then this one is 30, and then we have this quantum well in between. And we comprise a cavity of both the top and the bottom next to each other. And then we try to find like some guided modes in the system. And then the hope is that if we can find a guided mode, then we can start to make like interesting predictions about the operation of the system. And so this is an example of a VCSEL with what's called an anti-node configuration. So it kind of depends on exactly how thick you make each of these layers. So number 5 is basically the active layer, I think, in this system. And it's less than a quarter wavelength in thickness. And then you can see that it actually generates like a very nice looking field profile in the rosy plane. And basically what's happening is it's generating a lot of light here, but then this light, while it's of course localized to here because like it's a cavity and it tends to confine the light, it still emits a significant amount both above and below because of the geometry. If you had a back reflector here, of course, you can force it to just emit in one direction, right? So this is not like necessarily something that I claim you would want to build like right this second, but the argument is that we can kind of find nice structures that have like modes at a given frequency and have certain performance characteristics that we specify in advance. And then we can actually solve these pretty quickly and then produce nice pictures to kind of characterize the predicted operation. Yeah, this is just a graph of like how the resonant wavelength changes with diameter and then how the required material gain will change with that same parameter. So next time, we're going to talk about coupled mode theory.